Part of being a human being is a paradox. We're born human, but then we spend the rest of our lives trying to become human. And that becoming part, of course, is the social part. Yeah. It's the part that make where we realize we're not gods. We got to build a world together.
Hi, welcome to Freedom Dreams. I'm Amanda Alexander, founder of the Detroit Justice Center. Casey and the Freedom Dreams team and I are hard at work on a new season of the show. It'll come to you this fall, and I am so excited for you to hear it. But in the meantime, I want to share a conversation I had recently with the incredibly brilliant and tender-hearted philosopher Lewis Gordon. Our talk was hosted by Source Booksellers in Detroit's Cass Corridor this past winter. The last time I saw Lewis in person was in June 2019. He came to Detroit when the James and Grace Lee Boggs Center, of which I am a proud board member, was celebrating the late, great philosopher and activist James Boggs' 100th birthday. Lewis joined us that week in Detroit as a speaker. That week we held teach-ins and block parties and dance parties to celebrate James's life, philosophy, and legacy. To some extent, this Zoom conversation feels like a continuation of the week that I shared with Lewis in Detroit 3 years ago. That's because Lewis engages with James Boggs' ideas at several points in his new book, Fear of Black Consciousness. The book brings in Boggs' thinking on cities, his thoughts on what it means to take political responsibility, and how we might fight for something larger than and beyond ourselves, recognizing that our movements for freedom are global and intergenerational. Lewis's book speaks precisely to the moment that we're in. He helps us to understand the COVID-19 pandemic, police violence, and this latest wave of social movements and repression in the context of the past 5 years and the past five centuries and longer. His book weaves in history, linguistics, film interpretation with an incredible reading of Jordan Peele's Get Out, music, memory, mythology, and more. His sources and frameworks are so wide-ranging because his task is so ambitious, to understand the contours of society and how we make meaning, to tell the history of anti-Black racism, and always to orient us toward liberation. In that orientation, his book belongs to the radical, visionary organizing tradition, which James Boggs furthered so powerfully in his lifetime. Lewis offers us tools to ask better questions of ourselves, like how might we become agents of change? How can we expand our options and, as he puts it, build productive and life-affirming institutions of empowerment? If Lewis Gordon isn't a freedom dreamer, I don't know who is. Not surprisingly, we begin our conversation focused on Detroit. Detroit is a place ravaged by neoliberal capitalism. For decades, Detroiters have experienced an extreme retraction of the state in terms of its positive social welfare functions, such as providing quality education, reliable electricity, and access to water without the threat of shutoffs for inability to pay. And at the same time, Detroiters have experienced an expansion of the arm of the state that criminalizes, polices, prosecutes, and cages people, predominantly poor, Black, brown, and indigenous people, disabled people, and queer and trans people. And Detroit is also home to some of the most visionary organizing on the planet. In the face of devastation, Detroiters, often under the leadership of Black women organizers, have created life-affirming institutions in the form of urban farms and Black food sovereignty networks, worker-owned cooperatives, time banks and free stores, and community safety teams. In that sense, Detroit is a place of flourishing Black consciousness, full of people who have taken political responsibility for transforming the world.
Detroit is a paradox. Every effort to beat down Detroit, to beat down the people in Detroit, is met not with nihilism, despair, and or what some people like these days, pessimism, but a resolute resilience. The understanding that at the end of the day, we could talk all we'd like about these issues, at a certain point, it's what you're going to do. Yeah. Just what are we going to do? And it's wonderful to move through a city where there are people who, in every crack, every area, every wall, find a way to do something, find a way to make a flower grow. Mm. And that is something really inspiring. And if we connect to the question of why now, because right now, we are dealing with an assault on reality, an assault on truth, and an assault on democracy, and a failure to understand how they're intertwined. Mm. There are people who would like, when we talk about Black consciousness, the one with the little b, I may talk about two different kinds, to be the one that's completely governed by the negative imposition of what is constructed from an anti-Black, colonialist, misogynist society. But what a lot of people don't realize is that at the core, what is being done with those things is an assault on the dignity of the human being. Mm-hmm. You know, Fanon said that we forget that what colonialism has done is attempt to murder humanity. And a lot of people don't understand that that murder is not simply the question of what's done to people of color, but there's something when we try to make some people imagine they're above humanity, that is also a form of dehumanization. So in effect, the effort to construct white people as gods or any people as gods is also an assault on humanity. But then there's the capital B, Black consciousness. I love how in your summary, you brought that point out about what goes on in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And many places I bring it up in the book. I talk about it all the way from, as you know, from Detroit to Johannesburg, to all the way through to parts of Australia, to parts to, if we're talking about Trivandrum or Kerala, India, parts of Kerala, India, through from Kingston, Jamaica, the Bronx, New York, et cetera. And what a lot of people don't realize is that part of facing reality is facing our humanity. Part of being a human being is a paradox. We're born human, but then we spend the rest of our lives trying to become human. Mm-hmm. And that becoming part, of course, is the social part. Yeah. It's the part that make where we realize we're not gods. We got to build a world together. And that spirit is there. And this is one of the reasons why, yeah, thank you to the Source Bookstore for us to have this conversation in the context of Detroit, a city I can't wait to come back to when I'm able to travel again from my bout with my struggles with long COVID. But one other part about the why now, you know, I was asked to write this book 24 years ago. Hmm. And I'd started, but then the editor asked me to write it, left where the publishing house he was at. And so I just went and did my other things. And I'm so glad I didn't write it 24 years ago. Because you see, that point I said about becoming, it's about growing. And although the formal arguments were there, the experience going through working with comrades and folks in South Africa, getting to know the folks all across the United States, I've been fortunate enough to have been everywhere from coal miner country in the Appalachian Mountains, all the way through to the Andes Mountains, through to, as I bring up in the book, the outback of Australia, mm-hmm. through all these with folks in Soweto, et cetera, and the gravitas, the stuff that one learns along the way, and also the humility one develops mm-hmm. by learning from others. That enabled this now to take on a form of urgency, because we're suffering from a form of not a toxicity that's born of an arrogance from individuals who think that the end of them is the end of the world. Yes. But they don't realize it's not about them. It's not about the immediate us. It's about us across history, about mm-hmm. humanity. And so I'm so... You know, there are these moments, you know, there are times in life when you'd want to do something you didn't, and then you realize, thank God I didn't, because...
it ends up being right on time, yeah.
Yeah, this, because it speaks to now, because I would never, for instance, have understood the complexity of pandemics 24 years ago.
Mm-hmm. You know, I hope... How do you mean?
Well, because, you see, There are a lot of people who want to talk about pandemics in a very isolated, biological way. But the truth of the matter is, there have been multiple pandemics, and there are social pandemics. The social pandemics attempt to break us away from our sociality, from our ability to connect with each other. For instance, I always mention, I don't like to use the word social distance. I prefer to use the word physical distance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You and I are in different cities right now. We're physically distant, but we're socially close.
Yes.
Not only because of the communication, the connectedness we have for each other, but for all those who are participating, that's the connectedness. But neoliberalism, colonialism, want us to forget our connectedness, because then we become individualized consumer drones who are completely manipulated by market forces. And how in the world can an individual stand up to a state apparatus or institutions of power?
Right.
But when we remember our sociality, our ability to build better institutions, then we could do that. And those institutions are not only governing institutions, but they're institutions like this bookstore or these books around me, right? Mm-hmm. These are ancestors and contemporaries, these ways that we can connect with each other. That is an element that if that is broken down, what is produced is vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Colonialism, as I analyze it, is a pandemic. Racism, a pandemic. Genocidal practices, pandemics. The production of vulnerability that leads to refugees, that leads to the very notion of an illegal person. I mean, a person should never be illegal. You know, human, we are each other's keepers, so to speak. We're the custodians of life and dignity on this planet. And within that framework, then, what we have to understand is it's precisely the events over the past 5 years that radicalized the vulnerabilities that made what would have been a minor virus contained in a certain place, transformed into to devastation across the planet on many levels.
Yes.
All the pandemics we suffer from are actually human created, including climate change. And when we fail to understand it, that connectedness across pandemics, you see, that effort to isolate us in such a way that we're all vulnerable, mm-hmm. that's a connecting thread. And that's something I would never have realized 24 years ago.
Right.
But it's something that is a eureka moment, mm-hmm. an awakening and understanding, because one of the things you learn in a pandemic, we all learn right now, you know, and you probably experienced this, Amanda, our planet is tiny.
Yeah.
It's so tiny. I mean, our ancestors had to deal sometimes 3-4 years to go around it. These days, if it's going to take you more than 24 hours, you're pissed.
Yeah. Yep.
And we can communicate with each other right now, yeah. anywhere in this planet. And what we know right now in our tiny little blue dot, as Carl Sagan said, is that a sneeze anywhere can lead to a cough everywhere.
Yes. Yeah. Louis, I appreciated throughout the book, you are very consistent about trying to shift us away from this idea of things being moral and instead having it be political. And, you know, you have this chapter on privilege, luxury, and license that I found particularly useful. You're helping us to get out of this dead end of white guilt or white privilege. And it made me think of some work that Tawana Petty, who is a longtime board member at the Boggs Center, who you know, she had a book a few years ago where she was really exposing the scarcity mindset behind ideas of white privilege. So I'm hoping that you can talk about this distinction between privilege and license.
Sure. Well, first of all, liberalism, neoliberalism, and also white narcissism love actually the term privilege, even though they may complain about it, because it recenters them in such a way that it treats them as if everything is in their control. That's why often when we talk about racism, there are people, usually white people, who take it personally. It's just like often when one talks about sexism, there are men who take it personally, but that's narcissistic. If you take it personally, it becomes all about you or all about me when there's a problem that we share. And the issue isn't who are the good or the moral white people versus the bad ones. There are people out there who may meet those categories. But the problem with moralism, right, is that when you have a moralistic argument, at the end, if somebody just says, okay, I'll be more moral, then you both go home. And if it's a white person we're talking about, that person goes home to all of the structural resources supporting whiteness. Mm-hmm. And the black person may feel a sense of satisfaction that that white person now feels bad, but goes home to all the squalor that's imposed upon blackness. However, it gets deeper than simply that. You see, if you look at the things that we talk about as privileges, what becomes absurd is when we begin to list them, it gets weird. Mm-hmm. It really gets weird to talk about, for instance, having access to good schools, clean water, which is no joke in Michigan these days, right? No joke. When we talk about being treated fairly by a criminal justice system, when we talk about, you know, good education throughout, food, shelter, once you begin to unpack a lot of the things people talk about as white privilege, this is one of the profound injustices of liberalism and neoliberalism. Those things are rights. The issue isn't that whites have them. The issue is that they're being kept away from other people.
Yes.
It'll be absurd to tell anybody who has those things they should give them up.
Disavow their privilege of housing or, yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, it's so bad. I remember in South Africa, I came across black women from really the poorest townships who finally got a scholarship to university, who were being made to feel guilty about their privilege of being in a university. Mm-hmm. That's absurd. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing I began to dissect. The word privilege doesn't work with certain concepts, okay? And I'm distinguishing that from luxury. You know, for instance, luxuries are things you could get rid of and you're perfectly fine. But you know, privilege, there are certain things you don't have the privilege of. You shouldn't ever have the privilege to rape, maim, murder, the privilege to go in vigilante groups, and collect up people. No, those are wrongs. So it struck me that the language is problematic here. Because the problem is it doesn't connect to the notion of supremacy, and it doesn't connect to the notion of anti-Black racism. They're two different things, white supremacy and anti-Black racism. And a lot of people don't get this. But let's start with white supremacy. When you have access to doing something with no accountability, it is moved out of the realm of privilege into the realm of license. Mm-hmm. Now, what do I mean? If you think of like a James Bond movie, no one says James Bond has the privilege to kill. It makes no sense. James Bond has the license to kill. Now think about it. In this country's history, there have been lynchings of thousands of white people who have basically butchered the bodies of women and men. As Angela Davis pointed out, 40% of the lynchings were black women. A lot of people don't pay attention to this. And in these lynchings, they pose for the picture. So we know who the perpetrators were. Right. And they're perfectly fine. Because you see, that's a sign where their whiteness functions as impunity to accountability. Now, here's the thing. If you focus on the privilege argument, the moralistic argument, then you're busy trying to save people's souls, et cetera, but you're not changing the institutions of power. Now, if you want to change institutions of power, people have to be able to do something. Now, let's pick the license example. Mm-hmm. No matter what your race is, you may take the position that no human being should have a license to do whatever he, she, or they want to other human beings. So that means even if you have been granted that license, you can collaborate with, you can join a coalition of people who don't have the license to build a world in which nobody has that license. That is political. Acts transform power. And that's something we can do together. What's the point of talking to white people if there's nothing white people can do?
Right.
So the fact of the matter is we need to have political solutions to political problems. And the license analysis connect to things that nobody should have. But at the same time, in a critique of license, we can get to the things that everybody should have. Everybody should have the things we're now calling privileges. But now we need a more accurate language of talking about rights. We need to ask, what in the world turned rights into privileges? That's bizarre. Now, neoliberalism would love that. One of the things I often say to my students is, we live in a country where people say you're born with a right to life. But then we have a contradiction. Then we say, now you got to earn a living. This is what Jimmy Boggs was being critical of.
Yeah,
we have all this surplus. There's so much people could do. And it demeans their dignity to do this. We should have something where we could deal with what actual rights are.
Yes.
So we need more precise language. But that's a hint of it. Ultimately, it's about what we should be able to do. And I think what we need to understand is racism produces license. And whether it's white supremacy or anti-Black racism. And the reason I say that is a distinction is because if you could get rid of white supremacy, but still have anti-Black racism. And a lot of people don't realize that, because anti-Black racism is the position that Black people are inferior. So all the people either who are not Black or even some of the Black people could just say Black people are inferior, and you create institutions that block Black people from access to things for which all human beings should have a right. So we have a double task at hand, but ultimately it's a political task of fighting to transform institutions of power that will that would take the form that would enable people to live lives of dignity, freedom, respect, and flourishing.
Thank you, Lewis. And I'm seeing a couple of questions coming into the chat already, so we will get to those in a few minutes. I'm going to ask another question, but please keep those coming into the Q&A section, folks. So at the Detroit Justice Center, we talk a lot about building a just city. It's one of the things that we focus on and thinking about, not just what are we tearing down in terms of policing and criminalization and jails, but also what is affirmative vision of what we're building up or working towards. So idea of a just city. So I found your discussion of cities really insightful. You wrote that many places are mislabeled as cities when they're really urban centers that are managed places of consumption. And I think that this will resonate with many of us in Detroit. You write that many places mislabeled as cities have become urban places of entertainment for suburban whites. Younger whites armed with capital play in such places until they decide to raise families, at which point they take their white capital elsewhere, namely to the suburbs. Can you talk about the distinction between cities and managed urban centers and what's at stake in that distinction politically?
Sure. The point I just made about politics connects to citizenship. But the mistake people make is they think you have the cities and then you put people in for citizenship. But what they don't, what they fail to understand is that activities of citizenship produce cities. Now, when I say activities of citizenship, this connects to not only how we deal with institutions of power, but also how we deal with a complex question. For instance, you brought up the question of justice. But you notice I do a lot of etymological or analyses of language and their origins. And I also argue that there's another concept we need to have as well, along with justice. And this is something that goes all the way back to ancient East Africa and the concept of Maet. And that is the notion of health. Maet means not only justice, and interesting, the goddess Maet was the one with the scales. The European side of the Mediterranean made her a white woman with scales, but Maet also, the link to her term was also breath, life. You see what I'm getting at? So, and the problem is we live in Euro-modern capitalism and colonialism. Justice has been denuded of its life-giving element into a purely formalistic procedural element. And this is one of the reasons why people could claim justice has been met when people are being screwed over. Right. So one of the things we need to do is to bring that connection back in. And so if we get to the question of cities, citizens must be empowered. If you take empowerment out of the people in the urban space, then there, which is pretty much the project of urban policing, What happens is that they're now basically managed. And the example I give as synecdotal or a great example of this is Disney World.
Right.
I mean, Disney World is a perfectly managed semi-urban center.
Yep.
And as long as you consume, you are in a totalitarian state called Disney World.
Yep.
And they're good at it. They're really good at it. But here's the problem, right? The problem with it, of course, is you lose a voice, a say. Disney World is not democratic.
Right.
Citizenship is fundamentally democratic. It is the activities through which one can embody and mature and flourish as an agent over with political responsibility for one's environment. And so within that framework, if we look very carefully in the history of urbanization, particularly in the United States, when they were majority white, there was a state support of citizenship. As they became more brown and black, and within them, there were pockets of blocked working class groups to have access to citizenship. But through processes of unionization and other efforts, citizenship was clearly stated in terms of shared responsibility for power.
Yeah.
Okay. But what began to happen is the commitment of a society that's against the meeting of two terms, the word black and the word power. A society committed to keeping those apart meant that if blacks are in urban centers, the expectation is for black and brown people to be in urban centers without power.
Yeah.
But you need power for citizenship. So the task then is to bring together power, black, brown, and to remember the capital B, black, is actually a form of agency that's really dealing with the humanity of black people. And so one of the things I've argued is that this point about citizenship links to, and you notice I link it to Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
A lot of people think Black Lives Matter is a particularity, but that's the small b view. What Black Lives Matter is about is actual democracy.
Mm-hmm.
It's to argue that you cannot claim to be a democracy if your resources of power are designed to disempower communities of people. The mechanisms of social functioning should be designed to empower communities to be able to contribute to what they have to offer for the overall welfare and flourishing of everyone. So democracy, humanization are there, but the crucial thing is in a society committed to disempowerment in the form of blocking blackness, one has to unlock the potential of blackness in order to open the potential of democracy.
Yeah, so I'm especially appreciating at the beginning, you were talking about the relationship between justice and health and kind of thinking about justice beyond this idea of proceduralism. And, you know, I think that we think of it much more as, you know, cities in which, you know, communities have the capacity to care for each other. Political communities writ large, and where there would be investment of our resources into things like health, healthcare, mental health supports, and away from the things that criminalize and really hold back people's possibilities. I'm going to move us to our first question from the audience. This is from Rudy. He asks, throughout the book, Professor Gordon uses the term non-white. I wonder why he chose this term. I'm thinking of Biko's critical definition of non-white, being blacks who aspire to whiteness despite it being unattainable. In this light, non-white can be something of a slur and certainly represents a great gulf with the politically black. And he says, Rudy says, thanks for the excellent work.
Thank you, Rudy. And thanks for the question. Part of the work is to analyze problematic terms. So I use non-white in contexts in which I'm trying to point out and problematize the way we use white and the way we use also certain the technical term is semiological, But to put it differently, if we pick an example of a game, okay, what liberalism, neoliberalism, and forms of neoconservatism try to do. Neoconservatism is a little different because neoconservatism recognizes groups. It just takes the position that they're superior and inferior groups. But liberalism doesn't want to recognize groups. It wants to see only individuals. But here's the problem. If you have a certain game that has rules that say only certain people could play it, if you try to let certain people in, the rules are going to rewrite them into those other people. So it means, for instance, if you have a game where certain women come in, but the game is designed for only men, the woman comes in as a tentative male or a tentative man. And there's this form of way in which people who are not white are expected to come in as tentative whites, but it creates this problem in which it maintains the actual system designed to exclude the majority of those groups. So it is possible to change the players, but not the game, when the objective, if we go back to our political discussion, is to change the game. And if you think about it, one of the ways you change the game is to rethink how we think the categories. So if we come back to the non-white or black, et cetera, the old categories try to define people in such a way that a human being can be what he, she, or they are by themselves. But that's not what a human being is at all. In fact, technically speaking, a human being is not a thing. A human being is an activity. In fact, there are limits in our language because in many languages, being a human being is what you do. It's not simply what you are. So if we think about what you do, if you enter the game, if a human being is a relationship, then a woman entering the game as a relationship demands a new relationship, which means a different game. And if the excluded, historically excluded people come in as new relationships, it means we have to change the game. So within the framework of that question then, the point was to analyze the slurred element. And yes, I do bring up Biko, and there are others I could bring up, but as we know, but in this context, I have to give a shout out to Chobani Magani, who talks about this beautifully from South Africa. He also writes on Black consciousness in a powerful, beautiful way. And the idea is to understand Black consciousness as not a thing, but a form of committed activity. Mm-hmm. And this is the part, because a lot of people think this is about morphology. But as we know, if you're committed to a game of anti-Blackness, even if you got rid of the people whom we call dark skin or brown skin today, human beings will find a way to create new kind of people who represent Blacks. It just would be. So it's just like with misogyny. Misogyny can happen even if there weren't people anatomically whom we call female today. You can maintain it. So it was meant to bring out the nuance of trying to understand a more rich way and more active way of understanding what this human being is that we're fighting for when we're trying to transform the world into something better.
Thank you. Dwayne has a question. Dwayne asks, what is your opinion of Garveyism?
Oh, UNIA, the Garveyites. Garveyism is very complicated, mainly because first we have to start with just Garvey himself, right? Garvey didn't just sit in one place. He traveled. The thing about Garvey's charisma, Garvey's commitment, was that Garvey began to take very seriously. Garvey was very serious about political responses to political problems. This is one of the reasons why at one point in his life, Garvey was on the most dangerous individual list in the UK. I mean, well, you know, in the British Empire, in the US, all over the place, okay? So that's the political part. The thing that followed subsequently about Garveyism is what we have to understand is that anything created by human communities is never ultimately complete. It's never closed. Garveyism is a project. It's something in practice. Mm-hmm. And Garveyism grew out of stuff that we could also see, even though Garvey wasn't directly thinking so, in terms of some of the insights from Delaney. And it's a very important insight. And this is something many people miss. One of the things about being Black is that being Black is relational. You're always black and something. The commitment about being white is to lie to yourself that you can be who you are without being in relationship with anything else. That's why whiteness has the notion of purity. Now, once we understand that, we begin to understand why Garveyism, for instance, at one point, would appeal even to the Japanese. There's an extent to which Garveyism was constantly thinking in a more international global framework. The moment you begin to do that, you begin to understand an insight that I bring up in the book. And the insight is this: a big mistake many people make wherever they go is they think their version is the version. So the United States, people think their blacks are the blacks. Same thing in South Africa, yep. Same thing in the UK, same thing, you know, all of it. But it's not just there. Same thing when we talk about Jews. You know, there are a lot of people who think American Jews are the Jews. American Jews are part of the Jewish world, but they're not the only Jews. I'm from Caribbean Jews. And the list goes on. And there are many ways in which, again, if you're in a gender binary system, you think your women are the women. But the fact of the matter is, you might be talking to another group of people about women and find out if they're in a world with seven genders, they're talking about something a little different than a person in a binary framework would talk about it. So part of it is to enrich it. And one of the things about Garveyism, though, is what I will add to there is Garveyism has a fundamental ethic that we have to take very seriously. And this is one of the reasons why he had millions of followers and why elements of it continue to this day, all the way through to the fact that Malcolm X, right, El-Malik al-Shabazz, his parents met through Garveyism. Hmm. But they were connected, right? Because his mother was from Grenada. Hmm. And what that is this. At the end of the day, we could say a lot of things, but Garveyism comes down to say, look, black people, respect yourself. Mm-hmm. That may sound banal, but it's a serious thing. You cannot really do much in the world if you don't respect the value of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And we got to give it to them. The Garveyites were doers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. there's a question from Mikkel. The question is, I watched your interview with Hortense Spillers about Afro-pessimism. How can Black consciousness, with a capital B, incorporate the concerns of Afro-pessimism while simultaneously dreaming of and building a new world?
Well, the problem I have with Afro-pessimism is that it's locked in the lowercase b, Black. Mm-hmm. It ontologizes Blackness. It makes it complete and absolute. And what it does is it misses an important insight from Fanon. Remember when I said a human being is not properly a being? We're not really a thing? What Afro-pessimists read Fanon as saying when he said Blacks are in the zone of non-being is to argue to make the next move that Blacks are not human. But that is absolutely false. Fanon's critique was that in trying to make themselves into being, And there's a kind of deification of whiteness that actually makes white supremacy inhuman. In fact, it makes the attack on Black people, because Black people are actually exemplifying what is being avoided or evaded in white supremacy, which is that human beings are not being. That means that Black people are being attacked for our humanity. Now, this is a crucial point, because you're really lost if you're ashamed of what makes you a human being. And if you're going to treat your Blackness as if it's somehow something that's a trap. So this is where I talk about Black melancholia. Mm-hmm. And I also talk about potentiated double consciousness. But to make it plain, it's this. A big mistake many people make is that they think political action requires knowing the outcome before the performance. But most political action is a commitment to action through the humility of making the decision. It's not about you. Mm. Like when you came back to Detroit, Amanda, you didn't know what was going to happen. You just knew your commitments. You're going to do your best. Yeah. You did not know the various groups, institutes, functions you would be with. When Grace Lee Boggs and Jimmy Boggs were there, right? When we go to the Boggs Center, they didn't know. They came with a particular set of commitments. Mm-hmm. And when those commitments were in counterproductive situations, they asked why, and they thought through other ways to act. Yeah. So, and I call that commitment. And this is something may surprise some people, but I actually argue that real committed political action is premised upon radical love. The problem with the being, the narcissistic model, is it's based on the idea that you could only love people who look like you, are like you, but ultimately the only people who could be exactly like you ultimately becomes yourself. But the truth of the matter is non-narcissistic love is a commitment to the freedom of others with the right not to be like you. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, if you do real political action, it means that people are going to inherit the consequences of your action will be people you'll never know. And they're people who have the right to live a life that is going to be best suited for them. So this kind of understanding is something that I see missing in Afro-pessimism. And that part of that is because there are rhetorical phrases that some people like. They love to say things like, well, you got to burn it down and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, it's easy to burn things down. In fact, I call that moral laziness and political laziness. It's really easy. It's harder to build things up. And commitment, love, that's required to build things. It's really easy to tear things down. And I see that as a real insight in people like from Audre Lorde, all the way through to the Sisters in Black Lives Matter. They put in the time, the work. And I see it all the way back to what I talk about in the book. When I look at some of the people whose name most people don't know, but I say their names, like Harriet Bailey. There's so many ancestors who, if it weren't for their actions, for their love, for their commitment, we wouldn't be able to do squat. Mm-hmm. And all we are facing right now is our turn to think beyond the notion of the immediate to the commitment for what is ultimately greater than ourselves.
Thank you. Earl has a question. What are some concrete ways we can change the institutions of power?
Okay. So we're getting down to the pragmatic nitty gritty stuff. So this is where the political activist side of us come out, right? Well, first thing we have to begin with, there are times, you know, you have these conversations where people say we ought to do or we ought to have X or Y. And you notice some of the people who bring it up, then they get quiet and they look to the side for somebody else to do it. Usually when you think there's something that needs to be done, that's life calling you to do something. Mm. So that's the first step. Now, the second step, this is the humility step. If you're going to do something, you have to remember you're not a god. If you're going to do something, you have to do your part. Mm. It's communities who build things. And so concrete ways are going to be connected to, for instance, very practical questions of how we set up short-term plans, longer plans, long-term plans. If you start climbing a mountain by looking at the top, you may say, you know, maybe tomorrow. But if you start climbing a mountain by looking at the first step, the second step, the next steps, and along the way, you may find the journey is so rich and so fulfilling that along the way, some people may decide to build ponds, look along the way, grow fruits and trees. And then one day you may find yourself on the top of the mountain, but you may find, you know what, being on the top of the mountain is pretty empty. It was actually pretty cool, the journey with all those communities coming up. Mm. And then you realize you had a false consciousness thinking about the top, that it may be something else at work. So very practical things. First, work with people who actually do what they say they're going to do. There are a lot of people who make grandiose claims, but I'd rather work with a person who says, I'm going to do a series of small things. And every time I meet them, done. Yeah. Because you know what happens when a lot of small things get done? A very big thing gets achieved. So that's one. These are the kind of things that Grace Lee Boggs, Jimmy Boggs, many others, people like yourself, why we're acknowledging what you do, but there are many others. But the other thing is, it's not only those of us who are activists building institutions. You know, I grew up in communities with custodial workers, with hospital care workers, with people who are maids and so forth. And the way we think of these people is very misguided. One of the brilliant organizers I knew is my mother, who was a clerical hospital worker, was a little woman, 5'2", that a lot of people wouldn't realize was just changing the environment she was in. Hmm. And another way to think about it is our enslaved ancestors. I always have to remind people that a lot of the people enslaved from Africa and a lot of the indigenous people enslaved here, they were not brute, blind labor. They were skilled labor. The riches that we see in this country are a function of the gifts they brought. That shows their actions are consequential. It's just that those who are benefiting from their actions are narrow in terms of scope. We need to understand that every generation can contribute, and we need to find out the very specific things we can do. And then one final point, don't BS people. Really be truthful to yourself about what you're committed to and say, this is what I can do. Everybody can have something she, he, or they are excellent at, good at, okay at. And sometimes you need a lot of okays to get things done. And sometimes the excellent is what you need in leadership. And the good is what you need to make sure things get better. In other words, don't look at yourself in narrow, binary, this versus that term. Look at yourself in a multidimensional way of having many ways, many things to bring to build institutions. And I could tell you, every institution that I played a role in building, I could tell you over and over again, I noticed something. In the beginning, we said, man, this is going to take 10, 15 years. And then suddenly we find ourselves 2-3 years later saying, what happened? Why did it work? You know, and that's what I'm saying. You don't know the outcome before the performance. So focus on your commitment and bring your multiple dimensions to the table.
Lewis Gordon's new book is called Fear of Black Consciousness. Treat yourself to it at your local independent bookstore. In the meantime, I want to thank my favorite local indie Black-owned bookstore, Source, in Detroit, for hosting my conversation with Lewis. You'll hear from us a few more times before we launch Season 2 this fall, but in the meantime, please share our show with your fellow Freedom Dreamers and consider leaving us a glowing rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Talk to you soon.